Hey, welcome into the All Ball Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Gottlieb. Thanks so much for downloading, and I'm really excited for this week's pod. My guest is Jay Billis, lead college basketball analyst for ESPN, a former colleague of mine and someone I consider a friend. And it's interesting on how Twitter and sometimes debate segments on TV shows leave you arguing both sides. We'll get into some amateurism discussion, but I also think that Jay's kind of a fascinating guy. He's interesting to me. I think he'd be interesting to you as someone who, like me, grew up in Southern California. He went to Duke, starred there, and ended up being drafted in the NBA, played overseas, and then worked his way into being arguably the top broadcaster in the entire sport. In the meantime, he was also a grad assistant at Duke, and of course has very close ties to the Duke program. He called NCAA tournament games. He's done just about everything, including working with and then kind of usurping the great Hall of Famer Dick Vitale. So Jay Billis will be our guest, and we will get into some amateurism talk, but I don't think that's the only thing that's pertinent when listening to Jay Billis's story, because you've heard his side on amateurism, you've heard mine, but I think we'll have a thoughtful and engaging discussion. A couple other things you need to know about the NBA and about college basketball. They have changed some of the rules in the NBA, for example, or they appear to be going to change some of the rules in the NBA with the 14-second reset on offensive rebounds. I love that. I love it. As some of you know, I coached overseas last summer in Israel at the Maccabi Games, and I quickly learned just how different the game is based upon the rules and based upon the shot clock. Now, I knew about the 14-second reset, so it was something we'd actually practiced for. And one of the things I think it does is it doesn't allow you to bring it out, get a reset, get another set. And so it kind of makes the offense more attentive to getting a quick shot off the rebound. And it also makes the defense not just try and defend against the second shot, but also contest three-point shots on kickouts. My basic philosophy when I was coaching was, and would always be, even if you didn't have the 14-second reset, is you get an offensive rebound, and if you have a putback layup, fine. If not, we want to space and look to get a quick three, get a quick rhythm three, for a couple reasons. One, obviously the defense lets its guard down as everybody looks at the basketball and runs towards the balls like moth to a light. And so a lot of times your shooters are open. Secondly, shooters themselves, everyone shoots better when the ball is coming from inside out, much like your mom or your dad or your high school coach or your manager feeding you jump shots. You shoot a higher percentage when the ball is coming inside out. And then what I found is if you make it about, hey, let's get a dagger three, which is something that I know others have done it. I'm going to credit Davidson. They were the first I know of to really use it in the NCAA tournament. Of course, Duke borrowed it when they won a national championship in 2010. It was something that they changed. Really, really remarkable on how now the Golden State Warriors really use that philosophy. And you'll watch teams when they're playing Golden State, they give up an offensive rebound to Draymond Green or Andre Iguodala, and you'll see teams just run right to the shooters and not even concern themselves, sometimes with layups given up on offensive board. So it changes the way you coach offense. It changes the way you coach defense. It makes you much more attentive, not just to the boards, but to the open three-point shooters. And look, you get more shots up, you have more energy, it gets exciting as guys run to rebound and kick out, look to shoot threes, and it almost becomes a team three-point shot. You can almost track it like an offensive rebound is a team three-point shot, because oftentimes it takes an offensive rebounder, which means, you know, one person showing great effort. Oftentimes the kick out leads to even more moths running to lights. And then, you know, an extra pass or two or three extra passes, and then you ultimately get a three. Sometimes if all five players will touch the basketball, even though the idea is get an offensive rebound, you don't have a putback, you kick it out for an open jump shot. So I'm all for that rule change. I think it's a good one. The other one I'd like to see changed, I love international basketball, that you can touch a basketball when it's on the cylinder. Now, many people don't understand this rule if they're just a fan. And I know if you're listening to this show, you're probably a hardcore basketball fan or player or coach or whatever. But if you're not, just so you know, like, normal rules of goaltending, ball on the way down is still a goaltend. The difference is once it hits the cylinder, that's a live ball. And again, that makes guys go after the boards, go after the ball when it's on the rim. And on a second shot, remember, a second shot on a free throw, the ball is rattling around the rim, you can knock it off. On the other hand, You could also knock it in. And if defensively you try and knock it off and it goes in, the offensive team gets 2 points instead of just 1 point. So there is a risk reward to it, even though I think common logic would be it would cut down the percentage. You can't hit the ball through the inside of the rim, right? You can't go up through the net. So the normal rules of goaltending apply with the exception of the cylinder rule. I'd like to see that rule changed. I just would. I think that would, again, make it, you know, I don't know if it'd bring back the big guy, but to make the big guy more a part of college basketball, more part of the NBA, and I think that's a way to do so. So kudos to the NBA. I'm all for college basketball, also not resetting the shot clock all the way on an offensive rebound. I think that'd be a great idea, a great rule change as well. All right, let's welcome him in. He's the lead college basketball analyst for ESPN. Of course, he's called NCAA tournament games going back to when he worked also with CBS, and a Duke alum as not only as an undergrad, but also has a law degree. He's the one, he's the only, he's Jay Billis. He joins us here on the All Ball podcast. How do you want to be introduced? Like outside of like, what's the way in which when you walk into a restaurant and a friend introduces you to another friend, hey, this is Jay. I mean, because you do have a lot of stuff to your resume.
Boy, that's a good question, Doug. I hadn't really thought about that. I know when people say, hey, you know, what's your title? I always say just, you know, ESPN or ESPN basketball analyst or something. You don't need a whole resume deal. But that's what I see myself as now, just as a basketball broadcaster, not as a broadcaster, but specifically around basketball. So I'd probably say ESPN. I think they call us basketball analysts, you know, like we're trading stocks or something. I don't know when that happened. It used to be we were a color analyst. But yeah, I'd probably say ESPN basketball analyst.
Okay, there's a lot to basketball I'd like to get to, and there's some that believe you should be the commissioner of all things basketball with the NCAA. I want to get to that. But what about the college game itself? Do you like the game, when you call games, when you watch games, when you study games, do you like watching college basketball as much now as you did when you started in the biz?
I do. I think the game is in a really good place right now. I think for a period of years, maybe, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, and then for maybe a 10-year period, and I'm probably just, you know, guessing at that, I thought it had devolved into a clutch and grab game where it became overly physical and the officials were not calling the game the way it had been called maybe when you played or certainly when I played. And I think it scoring was going down. I think that was the reason. It wasn't that defenses were getting that much better. It's that they were getting away with more. And the coaches were way more creative and, as you know better than I do, sort of, you know, fouling with your chest and bumping cutters and grabbing guys coming off of screens and disrupting timing that were clear fouls that just weren't being called. So we've done a better job the last 2 or 3 years, I'd say, in cleaning that up, and I think the game's gotten better. I heard a little bit of what you were talking about before, and I agree with you 1,000%, is that, you know, whether we go to FIBA rules or whatever, there are so many things that we can do to enhance the game. And I understand and respect my colleagues. It may even be you at certain times saying, look, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But there's a part of me that says, you know, nobody ever says if it ain't broke, don't improve it, or if it ain't broke, don't maintain it. And there are certain things where the game evolves that we need to change. And I think FIBA's given us a great example of how they can adapt to the way coaches change, the way they're doing things, the way players change the way they're doing things, in order to stay ahead in the game, you know, staying as good as it can be. I mean, it's gotten faster. For a while, college basketball, as you know, it was the slowest game in the world. They had a 35-second shot clock, right? And we've gotten that down to 30. The world didn't spin off its axis. Everything was fine. If we went to 24, like when these teams go overseas and play, they do great. It would be just fine. And so I think we need to try to stay current as best we can. Doesn't mean we have to change everything and be like the NBA. I'm not suggesting that. Right. But we can certainly be more proactive and more adaptive, I should say, in keeping up with the way the game's being played.
You know, it's interesting. I've often thought that the NBA should go to the old college style free throws, and stick with me on the logic here. So every rule that the NBA has is because we would both agree those are the 450 best players in the entire world, right? So the three-point line is further. The lane is wider, although I know FIBA has adopted that lane. You only get 8 seconds to get it across the court. You get 24 seconds, you know, on the shot clock. They're obviously adapting the 14 seconds in the offensive board. In other words, you know, every rule is meant for the highest level of competition, and yet they only have 2-shot free throws once you get into the bonus. I think if you're like, look, we really want to keep, as you said, and I think it's a great way of looking at it, which I hadn't thought of, which is like, hey, just because you like college basketball doesn't mean you can't change some of it. Think about the changes that many of them have worked out for the better, including cutting down the clutching and the grabbing. But why not go to the 1-1 in the NBA? You know, listen, you don't have to go with five, but if they're truly the best players, why not put them under as much or more pressure as we see college players under?
Well, that's a fair point. I mean, but sometimes I look at it from the standpoint of, you know, like look, I don't know every game out there, but basketball is the only game I know of where you can score with no defense. And so when you go to the free throw line, oftentimes when you foul someone, if it's a common foul or fouling in the act of shooting, you know, you're not only sometimes you're taking away, well, especially in the common foul, you're taking away your opponent's opportunity to hit a three. And so they're, you know, it's really, free throws are supposed to be a deterrent. So I'm okay with sort of the international rule of, you know, five fouls per quarter, and then you're on the fifth foul, you have 2 shots. I'm not sure that when you foul, it should be on the offense. You know, there should be a sanction for the defense for fouling. Does that make sense? I mean, you know, I see both sides of it, and I'm okay with that. If we think the 1-1 is an integral part of college basketball, I'm cool with it. And if we want to argue for that for the NBA, that's fine too. But my thing sometimes winds up, wait a minute now, you know, if you foul and you're taking away my opportunity to get a three. And it's kind of like I've always felt like, and this is getting way off of what you're asking, and I apologize.
No, listen, it's a pod, Jay. You can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I guess we have more time. But so when there's a lane violation and they give the non-violating team if they're shooting, they give them another free throw. I'm like, I don't want another free throw. I want the ball. Like, you know, because if they violated and on a missed free throw, if you make it, you know, it counts. But if you miss it, they took away your opportunity to get a fair shot at an offensive rebound, which could lead to a three. So if there's a violation, the non-violating team should get the ball.
You know, it's interesting.
I'd rather have the ball than another free throw.
Well,
I've always felt like that should be part of the deal. And I don't care unless there's a foul. If there's any violation on the lane, if the shot goes in, who cares? The shot should count.
Right.
If you miss it, then the non-violating team should get the ball. And I've always I felt that way even when I was a player, when I was playing overseas. When I played pro ball overseas, I thought the FIBA rules were great. They just made more sense to me than the college rules. It doesn't mean they were all better, but most of them were. And we've been really slow for some reason in college, and I've sat on some of these committees. I'm on the NCAA's competition committee that Jim Delaney started several years ago as an LLC, and the NCAA brought it in-house. And the people on the committee couldn't be better people. I mean, they're all well-intentioned. They're great. But there is this kind of undercurrent of, well, we want to be different from the NBA. I mean, we don't want to do things like the NBA does it because we're this separate and distinct thing, and people like us because we're college and we're different. And I kind of sit there sometimes, and I respect the opinion. I just don't agree with that. I'm kind of thinking, I don't think people sit at home going, wait a minute, that rule's like the NBA. That's really offensive to me. I don't think they do that. You know, when we went to 30-second shot clock and all this other stuff that NBA's done in the past, like, look, I'm fine with if somebody doesn't want the NBA rule of in the last 2 minutes, you know, if you get a rebound called timeout, you can move it to half court. I get that if college doesn't want that. That's fine. But why we fight quarters, I'll never understand. And the one argument that I hear more often, Doug, on the quarters thing is, well, we don't want to be like the NBA. I'm going, they have quarters in high school. They have quarters in women's basketball. They have quarters in FIBA. You know, we're the only game in the world that doesn't have quarters. Like, what do we know that the rest of the world, you know, that we need to clue in the rest of the world on how dumb they are? We can't really justify why we have halves. It's just like our tradition. and we can't really say, well, this is why I like it. It doesn't make, you know, it kind of doesn't make any sense to me, as a lot of these things don't.
Jay, it is a little bit, of a college thing, which is, and this is one of the things I struggle with, is I watch, and these are, there's some great coaches, and I mean this. This is not like me talking out of both sides of my mouth. Guys that I think are really, really good. And, for example, a Tom Izzo, who I believe, you know, I'm a believer in the college system. I like guys going to college for a couple of years and learning about who they are, but also learning the game and learning a system and playing for the team, because you have the rest of your life to play for yourself. But I will say that, and this isn't just Izzo, you know, Roy Williams, I watch some of the stuff they do, and it's the exact same offense they ran when we played against Kansas in the late 90s and into 2000. And I kind of think it's one of the things with college coaches, not all of them, but a lot of them, they've had a ton of success. So why do we do it this way? Because this is the way we've always done it, right? And there's a little bit of that with the Habs. And I find that's the only disappointing part. One of the disappointing parts I find in college basketball is some of the coaches kind of fear this evolving basketball. Like you said, the international game, you watch some of the style of the NBA is much closer, or it has evolved much closer. Like the whole idea of ball and player movement, that's a European style that we adopted, and a little bit of a college style that we've adopted. But I find that the same thing you're thinking of with halves instead of quarters, I find with offensive and defensive systems, in that guys struggle to evolve with the game. And, you know, some of these other younger coaches have been able to use some of the European stuff, some of the NBA stuff, to great success, because they're going against colleges that still play two big guys and three guards. You know, they still run traditional systems that they've run because that's what they know best.
Yeah, I agree with that. And there are some guys that have done it a certain way for all these years, and it's been extraordinarily successful. Like, you know, you mentioned Roy Williams at North Carolina running the same stuff at Kansas, but it works, and it works at a really high level. And they play differently than almost any other, you know, major conference team, where they have two big guys, they run the same secondary break, and more teams are going with perimeter oriented stuff. So absolutely, I get that, and I'm okay with the way the game is. I just think there are certain ways we can push it forward. Like, I think right before I came on, I heard you talking a little bit about, you know, the sort of the idea that you had conveyed to me that the best players in the world, you know, the 3-point line is further back. And I've argued in college that we need to push it back to at least the FIBA distance. But it's not because it makes the shot harder. That in my view, and what I have seen sort of in my experience, has been the further the 3-point line out, the further it's pushed out, the better the spacing for offenses. And everybody's going to run their offense to that line. And oftentimes I've heard coaches, and you may have heard exactly the same thing. We run in the same circles, that, you know, coaches will say, hey, when we play in a bigger arena, we're practicing in an NBA facility, our offense runs better because we're spaced out to the NBA 3-point line. And so we have more room to cut, more room to drive, and all that stuff. And so I've argued for the 3-point line in these committee meetings to be moved back, not because I think there should be more risk-reward to the shot, and the shot should be more difficult. It's because I think it improves the spacing, and it makes it, the better the spacing, it's easier to officiate. And you know, the clutching and grabbing we're talking about is a lot easier to deal with. Like, when, you know, you probably, you know, you're a fair clip younger than I am, so you probably played with a 3-point line in high school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, see, I didn't play in college. I didn't play with a 3-point line at all.
Wait, didn't you guys have the short?
We never played with that.
I thought
one came into college basketball the year after I graduated, and you wouldn't believe how congested things were back then. Everybody packed it in and made you prove it over the top because it was a 2-point shot. And so when people say, well, the depth of the mid-range shot, you know, there's no mid-range game anymore. Why would you take a mid-range shot now? Back then, that was a good shot. But it's not a good shot anymore. It's not a valuable shot. You still want to be able to hit it. I don't, you know, I'm sure it's like bunting in baseball. You still want to be able to do it, but you're not doing it as often as you used to. And that's just sort of the way the game's changed. And I don't think the game's worse now than it used to be. I think it's way more exciting. I think the players are way more skilled now. Generally, they're better than they've ever been, athletically, skill-wise, nutrition, everything. They're longer, they're more athletic. It's totally better. It doesn't mean that Michael Jordan wouldn't be the best player now or Ralph Sampson wouldn't be the best. Maybe they would. But the average player now is way better than the average player was 20, 30 years ago.
All right, let's work our way back in time. All right, you grew up in Southern California in Rolling Hills. Were you always just a basketball player? Were you volleyball? Were you football? I mean, obviously, you were tremendous. Like, for people who don't remember you as a player, you were a very good athlete. So was it always just all ball?
I played baseball growing up in addition to basketball. I grew up I was born in 1963, so my formative years were in the 70s. And so you played, back then, you played the sport that was in season. And so my dad wouldn't let me play football. His thing was, you can play football when you get to high school. And he told me later on, his thinking was that if he could keep me away from football when I was a kid, I probably wouldn't want to play when I got to high school. Like, my dad thought football was a headbangers game, and it was just going to lead to injury and all that stuff. And so I played basketball and baseball, and I loved them both. But when I got to high school after my sophomore year, I played baseball until my sophomore year. And then even back then, coaches were pretty territorial. And so I had to choose. And so I basically quit baseball just to play basketball. And, you know, I was 6'7" once I got to high school. So it was pretty clear, like, basketball was probably what I was going to be better at and have a better opportunity to play in college or maybe after that. So I gravitated toward basketball, and that's pretty much all I did after my sophomore year in high school.
All right, so but your dad was a repairman, right? Like, he wasn't. It's really interesting. Our backgrounds are similar in Southern California, are similar in that I did actually play football growing up, but you did play the sport in season. But they're dissimilar in that your dad wasn't a basketball guy. What was he like as a parent in terms of you as a growing athlete?
Yeah, my dad was born in the United States. He was born in San Pedro, where I was born, in Southern California, near Long Beach, the Port of Los Angeles. And he worked when he was a kid. So he was a commercial fisherman when he was young. And then later on, after he got out of that, he went to technical school, and he got into TV sales and service. He was basically like a TV repair. He had a TV repair shop. And sold TVs out of there back when, you know, like when I was a kid, TVs were furniture. They had these big consoles that had a turntable in it and all that stuff. And so when your TV went on the fritz, like, my dad got called and he went on a house call. And if he couldn't fix it right there, he took it with him and back to the shop. And, you know, now your TV breaks, you throw it away. But back then, you know, you can make a significant amount of money fixing those things. He made all his money, really, not on sales, but of new TVs, but on service, on repairing things, repairing TV sets and all that stuff. So he did that, and then got out of it when I was, you know, just getting out of high school. But I grew up in a very nice area. Rolling Hills is a very nice area. It wasn't as sort of big money as it is now. It's become one of the wealthiest zip codes in the country now. But back then, there were a lot of people like my family that were middle class, that, you know, did well and everything. I never wanted for anything, but I came up the same way most people did. I mean, I walked to school every day and all that stuff. But I didn't. My dad never wanted me to work when I was a kid. Like, I had to do stuff around the house and all that, you know, yard work and all that stuff. But, like, he would not let me get a job. And my mom wanted me to work. She thought that, you know, a kid my age, you know, high school, all that, should get a job. And my dad, I remember my dad is really the only time I remember my parents kind of arguing. And his thing was, his job is to go to school and play ball. If he screws that up, then we'll make him work. But what good is bagging groceries going to be for him? And so I always, like, thought, Dad's awesome, man. He's keeping me from having to get a job. But I never worked in that regard. I just worked at what he thought I was supposed to do. And I had to work for him during the summer times, especially when I was in college. I did construction work during the summer for him. So that was really the only job I ever had before I got to college and worked during the summer times, like in the broadcast industry or something like that. I never really had a real job until that.
Okay, so let's again keep it with high school and growing up. Like, did you go to Five Star? What were the camps back then? Because mine was there was a camp in Santa Barbara, Westmont College called Snow Valley that I went to religiously. I think from the time I was like 8 to like 14 or 15. And then there was Superstar Camp in Santa Barbara I went to. And then the Pumps got involved right around, I was 13 or 14. And that's when it was West Coast All-Star. And then obviously ABCD, which was kind of a breakoff of the old Nike Princeton ABCD camp. Did you go to basketball camp? Like, what was your summer hoop like?
Yeah, when I was growing up, I played on, they called it a conference team. So rather than, like in Southern California, they didn't have school teams. So you didn't play for like your intermediate school. They had a team that played other intermediate schools. You know, you played for your local team. So we played probably 50 games a year traveling all around Southern California. And I promise you, I played in Tustin and your gym and San Clemente. I played in every high school in Southern California at one point or another between fourth and eighth grade. And then when I got to high school, I never went to basketball camp as a kid. So when I got to high school and was started being considered a pretty decent player, I got invited to, you mentioned, I got invited to, it's called the Sports World Superstar Camp. But when I was playing, it was in Point Loma near San Diego. So it was south of where you and I grew up. And so that was my first experience at a recruiting camp. And I got invited to some camps in the East, but I didn't feel like, I want to make my dad pay for me to get out there. Or, you know, I didn't understand how all that worked. So to me, the Superstar Camp was plenty. So I went to that twice, and that was the only basketball camp I ever went to. And then I played a little bit of AAU ball. I played for South Coast, which was coached by Gary McKnight. Who's now at Modern Day. He's had a Hall of Fame career at Modern Day. And so I played with Gary for a couple of years, a couple of summers, and then play, you know, so we would play in the BCI tournaments in Provo, Utah, and Las Vegas. But I didn't play a ton of, back then there weren't as many AAU teams. We played with our high school team in summer. So we played in the Long Beach City College Summer League and, you know, stuff like that. We played a lot of that stuff. And then I played in Rich Goldberg's American Round, what do they call it, the ARC League, the American Round Ball Corporation. Yeah. There I played for ARC, Washington. Yeah. It started as Slam and Jam in Long Beach. Sure. I played in that. So I played a ton of basketball all around Southern California, but it wasn't quite as, I mean, it was organized, but it wasn't like now with the Pumps and all that stuff where it's a business now. It was a little more sort of startup type stuff back then, and it was fun. Like, I, you know, it seemed like it during the summer. I played in either Long Beach City College or Cal State LA. I played for the U.S. Olympic Development League every summer. I played pretty much every night somewhere, and it was fun. It seems a little more like when my kid was going through the AAU thing. And playing every weekend, it was a little more professional, if that makes sense. And it was a little more, I don't know the right word for it. It was packaged. The kids still had a really good time. There was a ton of value to it, but it was a little grittier when I played, and I loved every minute of it. Because my parents didn't go. Now, if you're a parent and you don't go to your kids' games, you're like a bad parent. My parents didn't go to all my games. It was my thing. They came sometimes, and when they came, it was great. But if they weren't there, like it didn't bother me. I wanted to play, and so it was a different time.
So the drive to be great just came from within, or was it something? Was your dad somebody who pushed you? Was it your mom who pushed you? Like, where did you don't become as driven as you are, and you were driven academically as well, scholastically as well as in basketball? If not, I would think, and this is more maybe a parenting question. Obviously, you raising kids, you know, one that's, you know, graduated and the other one that's about to graduate. But where did your personal drive come from, within, or was it one of your folks?
Well, my dad never pushed me. My parents never pushed me. My mom would say stuff to me basically to get me to shut up, like if I was complaining. And because my mom didn't know anything about sports and didn't much care about it. She just kind of wanted us to do well and to have fun and to behave ourselves. So as long as, if I went to a game, as long as I behaved myself, my mom was happy with it. But, you know, she said some things to me that were very affecting. Like, there was one time, like, I came home from some event, and I thought, I had been the leading scorer and all that stuff, and I thought I should have been the MVP of this tournament I played in. And I had made some statement about, well, I'm just not getting the ball enough. And my mom looked at me and said, "You're a big boy. If you want the ball, go get it." And I was like, here's this little lady telling me, doesn't know anything about sports, telling me if I want the ball, go get it. I better go get it. And my dad would say the same kind of thing if I complained. Like, he never said, "Hey, man, you didn't do this. You need to do this better." He wasn't built like that. He didn't care about that. So he wanted me to, I'm sure he wanted me to do well and all that stuff and had expectations, but he never really voiced them. But he would basically say, like, if I would, that was kind of the big guy's lament is they don't throw the ball inside. And my dad would go, "Look, I've been watching these games. Your teammates miss a lot of shots. Why don't you go get the rebound? And you can get the ball anytime you want. Go get it." And so I remember that. But they never pushed me. What was kind of motivating was I have an older brother who's 7 years older than I am, and he was a kick-ass good athlete growing up. Like, he did everything, and he's a great golfer. He's a really good. He's a great baseball player, good basketball player. But he's small. He's smaller than me. He's only like 6'2", and so he had. When we roomed together growing up, and he had, Doug, I'm no joke, he had like 125 trophies in our room. Every time he went somewhere, he won. And so, like, my parents' friends would come over to the house, they'd give him the nickel tour or something. They would always stop in my brother's in our room, and they would marvel at how many trophies my brother had won. And his name's Dave, and just a stud, and he was my idol growing up. And that motivated me more than anything, was I wanted to do things well so that I could try to match him. And finally, like, when I was like a senior in high school or something, I finally like got as many trophies as he did. And it was like a huge day for me when I matched it. And that was more motivating to me than having, my parents say, "Hey, you got to do that." My parents, the only thing that my mom ever really got on me about was school. She expected me to take care of my schoolwork because she, my parents had a very healthy fear of my failure. So their thing was like, "Look, people are saying you're good at basketball, but you better do your homework because, you might not be as good as you think." And that was sort of the lament or the mantra in our house was, "College of your choice. You got to be able to. Your grades have to be good enough so that you can get into the college of your choice." And once I got good at basketball, I was pretty sure I could go where I wanted. So I didn't do my homework quite as fervently as I did before.
I know that you were part of Duke. That was the number one recruiting class in the country, and it was an amazing list of Allery and Dawkins and Dave Henderson. And you're part of what kind of set in place this path to an incredible legacy that Coach K is going to leave behind at Duke. But you did grow up in Southern California, and I know UCLA wasn't at its peak, but you grew up in the 70s in Los Angeles. Was Larry Farmer was the head coach, I believe, right? It was Larry Brown and Larry Farmer. Did he not offer you? Were they late to the party? Why wasn't UCLA considered, especially, growing up there and being a good student?
When I was a sophomore in high school, Larry Brown was the head coach at UCLA, and he'd gone to the Final Four in like 1980, my sophomore year, and they lost to Louisville. And he had expressed interest in me as a player, and like you're saying, you grow up in the shadow of UCLA. That was sort of a goal that you had as a player, like, someday I'd like to play at UCLA. And I had a lot of guys that I'd played against that had gone there, and so when Larry Brown left and went to the San Antonio Spurs, or no, the New Jersey Nets, I think it was, and went into the NBA, UCLA hired Larry Farmer, who had played, played there and won national championships with Walton and all that. And they recruited a guy who was in my class named Kerry Bogney, who ultimately wound up going to Kansas. So he had committed to UCLA, and they thought they had their big guy. So they kind of didn't really show the same kind of interest that I was getting from seemingly everywhere else. And so You know, that was a little bit disappointing. So I kind of said, all right, well, you know, if that's not of interest to you, then I'm going in this other direction. So when Kerry Bogney kind of turned tail and went to Kansas, I didn't have a whole lot of interest in UCLA when they thought, well, maybe we should turn in this direction.
Yeah,
and my dad made sure that wasn't going to happen because I'd already made my mind up. I was going to Duke, and he was not about to have something. So I have no idea whether I got every phone call because my parents had said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is over. And I know some places had called. Because there was only one signing period back then, it was in April, and I knew places had called that had had coaching changes, and you know, I didn't find out about some of them until afterwards.
Well, but Coach K wasn't Coach K then, so what was it that appealed to you about Coach K that, you know, made you get on a plane and want to fly all the way across the country and play at Duke, which is a place where, if anybody's ever been there, not only beautiful and completely different than Southern California, but it's also mostly populated by kids from the Northeast. What was it about Duke and Coach K?
It was all Coach K that, you know, when I was in high school, I had a little bit of a difficult experience with sort of the coach there. You know, I'm really tight with all my teammates, and we had a great experience with each other, but it wasn't a great experience with our coach. And I had, in my 4 years of high school, there were three different head coaches of the varsity when I was there. And the last person that had it, it wasn't a pleasant experience. And so I
hold on, wait, were you a coach killer?
I figured out at least that, my choice of college, was going to be the only time in my basketball life probably that I was going to be able to choose who I played for. So the coach was the most important thing to me. And it really wound up dictating my final schools. It was less about the schools and more about the coaches. And, like, oddly enough, so the four schools I came down to at the end were Duke, where Coach K was, Syracuse, where Jim Boeheim was, Iowa, where Lute Olson was, and then Kansas, where a guy named Ted Owens was at the time.
Sure.
And so those were the four coaches I was most interested in playing for. And, you know, three of them are now in the Basketball Hall of Fame, which is kind of weird. But Coach K was the least accomplished of the four. Had not, you know, this kind of sounds odd, but it's true. My first NCAA tournament game was Coach K's first. Wow. And he'd never been there before. And you know, my first ACC championship was his first. My first Final Four was his first. And so it was kind of a weird issue that he was the least accomplished, but he was the guy I trusted the most. And he never lied to me. When I was being recruited, there was you were from a little further south in Orange County, but there was a restaurant in my area called the Red Onion. And sure. It was this Mexican joint, you know, and so when Coach K visited me at my high school, I could go off campus for lunch. So we went to this little Mexican place. I mean, this is like 1981. And so, you know, you go to the Mexican joint and have lunch. I mean, it might be $4 for me and $4 for you. So the bill was probably $10 for the two of us. And I mean, I don't know if this happened to you, Doug, but, you know, back then, it wasn't that people didn't respect the rules, but there was nobody else I went to lunch with where I had to pay. And Coach K split the bill with me. And he said, look, this is stupid, but we have to pay for our own. And I was like, all right, this dude's legit, man. He's not going to, everything he says is right down the middle. And I was being recruited by other schools would negatively recruit against Duke by saying, hey, you know, if you go to Duke, you're going to play center there for 4 years. And I was like, nah, he wouldn't, you know, that wouldn't happen. And I wound up, it became such an issue, I wound up asking him about it. And I said, you know, everybody's saying that you're going to make me play center if I come to Duke. And he goes, well, for a year, yeah. Like, you know, we don't have anybody to play it like you could. So for a year, yeah. But I'll recruit another big guy, and you can move back to your natural position. And he did. It's just the big guys weren't quite what he expected, and I never got to move out of there. But he never lied to me and told me right away, like, for a year, yeah, you're going to have to do it. And I respected that, and I really liked him. and I trusted him from the get go. And it was different back then. He was younger. He was very very energetic. He still is that. And he was, man, if you made a mistake, you heard about it right away. And there was no mistaking kind of where you stood overall and at that moment. And it wasn't always pleasant on that end, but you knew you were getting the absolute truth. And that really appealed to me.
But wait, now, didn't your sister go to UCLA?
She did. My sister was a great volleyball player. So she was a freshman when I was a senior. And so, you know, me being in the East, you know, you couldn't get back like now. There's no internet or all that. So I never really saw my sister play high school volleyball. And then when I watched her play, when she got to college at UCLA and I came back for Christmas my senior year and watched her play at UCLA, I was blown away by how good she was and by how good her team was. But yeah, she played volleyball at UCLA and was a Phi Beta Kappa student. My sister, turns out, her name's Cheryl. She still lives in Newport Beach. She was the best athlete in our family. She was the best at everything. She's the best student, best athlete. It's ridiculous how talented she was and is. And I always kind of thought it was me and my brother. And then I found out later on, I was like, no, we're pulling up the caboose on this train. She's the number one athlete in our family.
Yeah, and she wasn't the high school coach killer that you were. I mean, that's really the legacy.
Exactly.
The legacy you leave behind. So you get to Durham. And I remember, it's interesting, you talk about being honest. And that's one of the reasons I chose Notre Dame was John McLeod was honest, whereas I felt like it wasn't that Jim Herrick wasn't honest. He was, you know, they had taken a commitment from a kid named Olujimi Man, who was a year behind me, and they were still recruiting Stephon Marbury. And I'd say, like, listen, coach, you got Cameron Dollar there, and I'd be a freshman. He's a junior. You know, would you promise me to not to recruit over me? What, Dougie, five guys. We play the best five guys at UCLA. Whereas John McLeod gave me his word that I'd start as a freshman, and I did, and he wouldn't recruit over me, and he didn't. But I remember getting to Notre Dame, and again, different part of the country than Durham. I think both are beautiful campuses, although the weather far better in North Carolina. And even though I had traveled a lot with basketball and a lot with my family, having family in the East Coast, I was incredibly homesick. Did you go through that?
A little bit. Mine was more the culture change that, you know, back then, like right now, I live in North Carolina now, in Charlotte, North Carolina, and like Chick-fil-A is closed on Sunday. Well, when I was in college, everything was closed on Sunday. And so it was just a different world. It was the Bible Belt. And you had mentioned sort of the makeup of the college campus. And that may have been exactly right as far as, you know, a lot of people from the Northeast and all that, as far as the student body was concerned. But you walked off campus and you were in the South. And so that was a huge culture change for me. And even though, like, you're right that the weather in Durham, North Carolina is a lot better than it is in South Bend, Indiana, but I was still freezing my tail off during the wintertime relative to what Southern California was. Like, I'm 54 years old now, and I am still not used to the weather in the East. Even where I live, which is a mild climate, you know, in North Carolina, it's hotter than blazes during the summer, and I still get chilly during the wintertime. And, you know, I didn't own a coat when I grew up in Southern California. I had a sweatshirt and a windbreaker, but I didn't have a coat. And
I had to buy one
when I went back East. I wasn't homesick as much as I was, this isn't what I'm used to. Like, so it was an adjustment period. And then the basketball part was a huge adjustment because you were going from, you're going into, you know, arguably the best league in the country back then. Like, my first ACC game, I had to guard Ralph Sampson. It wasn't much of a contest. And Michael Jordan was at North Carolina, and Sam Perkins and all that. So NC State won the national championship my freshman year out of our league, and I think they finished fifth in an eight-team league and won the national championship. It was a tough way to be sort of welcomed into college basketball to play in that league with all freshmen.
Yeah, no, listen, we were young and we finished, I probably was like, it was back when the Big East expanded, and Syracuse finished fourth in the league and lost the national championship game to Kentucky. You know, that was UConn had Ray Allen and Nova had Kerry Kittles and Georgetown was two in the country and they had Allen Iverson. So okay, let's start with Ralph Sampson, 3-time player of the year. Some of it was injuries, but some of it was his game didn't translate to the NBA. You played against him when he was at his absolute peak. What was it? What was Ralph Sampson like?
Ralph was 7'4". He was an incredibly graceful athlete that if he were 6'7", would have been a great player because he could shoot it. He had great hands. He could really run, super athletic. I actually think that his game did translate to the NBA, that he was a 2010 guy every year that he was healthy and was MVP of the All-Star game in 85 and played, you know, he and Olajuwon were the twin towers there with the Rockets. But I remember seeing him play, I was playing overseas, I think, and I came back, it was probably like 1990, 89-90, and I came back during the after my season was over, and I happened to be in Houston. He was playing for the Sacramento Kings at the time, and his knees were shot, and he couldn't run anymore relative to what he could do before. And I remember going, God, it was like really sad to see a player that was so great be diminished in that way. And, you know, he's now in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, and I think rightfully so. But I think a lot of people who look back on that time remember him as a diminished player when his first 5 years in the league, maybe a little bit longer, he was unbelievably good and played incredibly, like all-star caliber well. But his body broke down, and that was sort of the difference. But he was like 2- or 3-time National Player of the Year in college. Nobody could deal with him. Nobody could.
What was he? But was he a finesse player?
Kept, like, the 3-point line would have helped him because it would have given him more space to operate, because he got triple teamed every time he touched it.
I know that you were part of Duke. That was the number one recruiting class in the country, and it was an amazing list of Allery and Dawkins and Dave Henderson. And you're part of what kind of set in place this path to an incredible legacy that Coach K is going to leave behind at Duke. But you did grow up in Southern California, and I know UCLA wasn't at its peak, but you grew up in the 70s in Los Angeles. Was Larry Farmer was the head coach, I believe, right? It was Larry Brown and Larry Farmer. Did he not offer you? Were they late to the party? Why wasn't UCLA considered, especially, you know, growing up there and being a good student?
When I was a sophomore in high school, Larry Brown was the head coach at UCLA, and he'd gone to the Final Four in like 1980, my sophomore year, and they lost to Louisville. And he had expressed interest in me as a player, and, you know, like you're saying, you know, you grow up in the shadow of UCLA. That was sort of a goal that you had as a player, like someday I'd like to play at UCLA. And I had a lot of guys that I'd played against that had gone there, and so when Larry Brown left and went to the San Antonio Spurs, or no, the New Jersey Nets, I think it was, and went into the NBA, UCLA hired Larry Farmer, who had played, you know, played there and won national championships with Walton and all that. And they recruited a guy who was in my class named Kerry Bogney, who ultimately wound up going to Kansas. So he had committed to UCLA, and they thought they had their big guy. So they kind of didn't really show the same kind of interest that I was getting from seemingly everywhere else. And so you know, that was a little bit disappointing. So I kind of said, all right, well, you know, if that's not of interest to you, then I'm going in this other direction. So when Kerry Bogney kind of turned tail and went to Kansas, I didn't have a whole lot of interest in UCLA when they thought, well, maybe we should turn in this direction.
Yeah,
and my dad made sure that wasn't going to happen, because I'd already made my mind up. I was going to Duke, and he was not about to have something. So I have no idea whether I got every phone call, because my parents had said, well, wait a minute, you know, this is over. And I know some places had called, because there was only one signing period back then. It was in April, and I knew places had called that had had coaching changes, and you know, I didn't find out about some of them until afterwards.
Well, but Coach K wasn't Coach K then. So what was it that appealed to you about Coach K that, you know, made you get on a plane and want to fly all the way across the country and play at Duke, which is a place where, if anybody's ever been there, not only beautiful and completely different than Southern California, but it's also mostly populated by kids from the Northeast. What was it about Duke and Coach K?
It was all Coach K that, you know, when I was in high school, I had a little bit of a difficult experience with sort of the coach there. You know, I'm really tight with all my teammates, and we had a great experience with each other, but it wasn't a great experience with our coach. And I had, in my 4 years of high school, there were three different head coaches of the varsity when I was there, and the last person that had it, it wasn't a pleasant experience. And so I
hold on, wait, were you a coach killer?
I figured out at least that my choice of college was going to be the only time in my basketball life, probably, that I was going to be able to choose who I played for. So right. The coach was the most important thing to me, and it really wound up dictating my final schools. It was less about the schools and more about the coaches. And, like, oddly enough, so the four schools I came down to at the end were Duke, where Coach K was, Syracuse, where Jim Boeheim was, Iowa, where Lute Olson was, and then Kansas, where a guy named Ted Owens was at the time.
Sure.
And so those were the four coaches I was most interested in playing for. And, you know, three of them are now in the Basketball Hall of Fame, which is kind of weird. But Coach K was the least accomplished of the four. Had not, you know, this kind of sounds odd, but it's true. My first NCAA tournament game was Coach K's first. Wow. And he'd never been there before. And you know, my first ACC championship was his first. My first Final Four was his first. And so it was kind of a weird issue that he was the least accomplished, but he was the guy I trusted the most. And he never lied to me. When I was being recruited, there was you were from a little further south in Orange County, but there was a restaurant in my area called the Red Onion. And sure. It was this Mexican joint, you know, and so when Coach K visited me at my high school, I could go off campus for lunch. So we went to this little Mexican place. I mean, this is like 1981. And so, you know, you go to the Mexican joint and have lunch. I mean, it might be $4 for me and $4 for you. So the bill was probably $10 for the two of us. And I mean, I don't know if this happened to you, Doug, but, you know, back then it wasn't that people didn't respect the rules, but there was nobody else I went to lunch with where I had to pay. And Coach K split the bill with me. And he said, look, this is stupid, but we have to pay for our own. And I was like, all right, this dude's legit, man. He's not going to, everything he says is right down the middle. And I was being recruited by other schools would negatively recruit against Duke by saying, hey, you know, if you go to Duke, you're going to play center there for 4 years. And I was like, nah, he wouldn't, you know, that wouldn't happen. And I wound up, it became such an issue, I wound up asking him about it. And I said, you know, everybody's saying that you're going to make me play center if I come to Duke. And he goes, well, for a year, yeah. Like, you know, we don't have anybody to play it like you could. So for a year, yeah. But I'll recruit another big guy and you can move back to your natural position. And he did. It's just the big guys weren't quite what he expected, and I never got to move out of there. But he never lied to me and told me right away, like, for a year, yeah, you're going to have to do it. And I respected that, and I really liked him, and I trusted him from the get-go. And it was different back then. He was younger. He was very, very energetic. He still is that. And he was, man, if you made a mistake, you heard about it right away. And there was no mistaking kind of where you stood overall and at that moment. And it wasn't always pleasant on that end, but it was. But you knew you were getting the absolute truth. And that really appealed to me.
But wait, now, didn't your sister go to UCLA?
She did. My sister was a great volleyball player. So she was a freshman when I was a senior. And so, you know, me being in the East, you know, you couldn't get back like now. There's no internet or all that. So I never really saw my sister play high school volleyball. And then when I watched her play, when she got to college at UCLA and I came back for Christmas my senior year and watched her play at UCLA, I was blown away by how good she was and by how good her team was. But yeah, she played volleyball at UCLA and was a Phi Beta Kappa student. My sister, turns out, her name's Cheryl, she still lives in Newport Beach. She was the best athlete in our family. She was the best at everything. She's the best student, best athlete. It is ridiculous how talented she was and is. And I always kind of thought it was me and my brother, and then I found out later on. I was like, no, we're pulling up the caboose on this train. She's the number one athlete in our family.
Yeah, and she wasn't the high school coach killer that you were. I mean, that's really the legacy.
Exactly.
The legacy you leave behind. So you get to Durham, and I remember it's interesting. You talk about being honest. And that's one of the reasons I chose Notre Dame was John McLeod was honest, whereas I felt like it wasn't that Jim Herrick wasn't honest. He was, they had taken a commitment from a kid named Olujimi Man, who was a year behind me, and they were still recruiting Stephon Marbury. And I'd say, like, listen, coach, you got Cameron Dollar there, and I'd be a freshman. He's a junior. Would you promise me not to recruit over me? What, Dougie, five guys. We play the best five guys at UCLA. Whereas John McLeod gave me his word that I'd start as a freshman, and I did, and he wouldn't recruit over me, and he didn't. But I remember getting to Notre Dame, and again, different part of the country than Durham. I think both are beautiful campuses, although the weather far better in North Carolina. And even though I had traveled a lot with basketball and a lot with my family, having family in the East Coast, I was incredibly homesick. Did you go through that?
A little bit. Mine was more the culture change that, back then, like right now, I live in North Carolina now, in Charlotte, North Carolina, and like Chick-fil-A is closed on Sunday. Well, when I was in college, everything was closed on Sunday. And so it was just a different world. It was the Bible Belt, and you had mentioned sort of the makeup of the college campus, and that may have been exactly right as far as, a lot of people from the Northeast and all that, as far as the student body was concerned. But you walked off campus, and you were in the South. And so that was a huge culture change for me. And even though, like, you're right, that the weather in Durham, North Carolina is a lot better than it is in South Bend, Indiana, but I was still freezing my tail off during the wintertime relative to what Southern California was. Like, I'm 54 years old now, and I am still not used to the weather in the East. Even where I live, which is a mild climate, in North Carolina, it's hotter than blazes during the summer, and I still get chilly during the wintertime. And, I didn't own a coat when I grew up in Southern California. I had a sweatshirt and a windbreaker, but I didn't have a coat.
I had to buy one
when I went back east. I wasn't homesick as much as I was, this isn't what I'm used to. It was an adjustment period. And then the basketball part was a huge adjustment because you were going from, you're going into, arguably the best league in the country back then. Like my first ACC game, I had to guard Ralph Sampson. It wasn't much of a contest. And Michael Jordan was at North Carolina and Sam Perkins and all that. So NC State won the national championship my freshman year out of our league. And I think they finished fifth in an 8-team league and won the national championship. It was a tough way to be sort of welcomed into college basketball to play in that league with all freshmen.
Yeah, no, listen, we were young and we finished, I probably was like, it was back when the Big East expanded, and Syracuse finished fourth in the league and lost the national championship game to Kentucky. That was UConn had Ray Allen and Nova had Kerry Kittles and Georgetown was two in the country and they had Allen Iverson. So, okay, let's start with Ralph Sampson, 3-time player of the year. Some of it was injuries, but some of it was his game didn't translate to the NBA. You played against him when he was at his absolute peak. What was it? What was Ralph Sampson like?
Ralph was 7'4". He was an incredibly graceful athlete that if he were 6'7", would have been a great player because he could shoot it. He had great hands. He could really run, super athletic. I actually think that his game did translate to the NBA, that he was a 2010 guy every year that he was healthy and was MVP of the All-Star game in 85 and played, he and Olajuwon were the twin towers there with the Rockets. But I remember seeing him play. I was playing overseas, I think, and I came back. It was probably like 1990. 89-90, and I came back during the after my season was over, and I happened to be in Houston. He was playing for the Sacramento Kings at the time, and his knees were shot, and he couldn't run anymore relative to what he could do before. And I remember going, God, that's it was like really sad to see a player that was so great be diminished in that way. And, you know, he's now in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, and I think rightfully so. But I think a lot of people who look back on that time remember him as a diminished player when his first 5 years in the league, maybe a little bit longer, he was unbelievably good and played incredibly, like all-star caliber well. But his body broke down, and that was sort of the difference. But he was like two or three time National Player of the Year in college. Nobody could deal with him. Nobody could.
Well, was he? But was he a finesse player?
Like, the 3-point line would have helped him because it would have given him more space to operate, because he got triple teamed every time he touched it.
All right, that's part one of my interview with ESPN college basketball savant analyst Jay Billis. Coming up in part two, I'm going to ask Jay about replacing Mike Krzyzewski. I'm going to give him the list of all the potentials, the Jeff Capels, the Quinn Snyders of the world, the Steve Wojciechowski, Chris Collins. Like I'll give him every possible name, Johnny Dawkins, Tommy Amaker. Who's the right, Mike Bray, who's the right guy to replace Coach K? You'll find out in part two of my conversation with Jay Billis. So that's it for this episode of All Ball. Make sure you subscribe, you download, you rate us. Listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show live on Fox Sports Radio daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific. And stay tuned next week. We'll have a great recap of the first couple weeks of the open recruiting period. And we think now that the dust has settled, we'll begin to take a look at all that has changed in the NBA rosters. Keep listening. We appreciate it. I'm Doug Gottlieb. This is All Ball.